You are listening to Walking Home from the ICU. We will be exploring how to save and preserve lives in the ICU. All opinions and views shared are unaffiliated with any organization. Hello and welcome back. New listeners, thank you so much for joining us. And for all the listeners, thank you for your growing support. It is exciting to see how many people across the globe care about patient outcomes. Those that are new with us, start from episode one and don't miss the great content we've had thus far. Listeners have reached out with lots of wonderful questions, and some of them have been about an established culture in the ICU and seasoned nurses. They've asked questions like, can you teach an old dog new tricks? And I believe that when it comes to well-intended nurses, you definitely can. Paula joins us now to share with us what it was like for her as a very seasoned nurse to step into an environment that defied decades of experience and practice. Paula, thanks for joining us. Can you tell us a little bit about your career timeline and where it all began?
Hi, Callie. My timeline, let's see. I became a nurse in 1991, graduating from a diploma school of nursing, and went to work at a community hospital in the state that I lived in. Did a year of practice on a cardiac step down unit, telemetry unit, which was required back then before ever going to the intensive care unit. It had to get you a little bit of background in basically med-surg type nursing, build you a good base to take off on. I was at that facility for 8 years before joining the travel world of nursing, and traveled for a couple years to some great teaching facilities across the United States. Ended up back at Ohio State University in Columbus, Ohio for another 8 years in a 42-bed unit that we did cardiac, respiratory, pulmonary, burn, trauma, and medical surgical type nursing. So we were quite a multidisciplinary unit. I left that facility and came to Utah, and have also worked at some teaching facilities, multidisciplinary surgical ICU, burn trauma, and some standard generalized medical ICU since then. So 29 years later, I'm still in the ballgame for now.
That is a lot of experience. So you're kind of a hidden treasure in our ICU community. And before coming to the Awake and Walking ICU, after all those years of practicing, what was your perspective and practice with patients who were on mechanical ventilation? What was normal for you?
Normal for me, and also wide for the, basically generally ICU and somebody that was ventilated, is they were receiving sedation, either with morphine, fentanyl, Versed, some paralytics sometime depending on the situation. And the only time that sedation was lightened was with possible anticipation to see if they were ready for extubation or removal of their, the breathing tube.
And after all your travels and throughout decades of experience, that is normal, right?
That was the norm. You were intubated, you got the sedation package that went along with it.
One comes with the other.
Correct. No other option. Ventilated, you were sedated and restrained, and that was the whole situation.
And so what was your first impression when you came into an Awake and Walking ICU?
Well, I was forewarned when I came to the Awake and Walking ICU that they don't sedate their patients. And, I thought then, what's so bad about that? I kind of grew a lot, hopefully, over the years of nursing, and went through a lot of changes, especially during the years of evidence-based practice nursing that went away from, you still had your textbook nursing, but through trials and things like that, they found that certain things were a lot better if you didn't do things or if you did them a different way, which after years of nursing, you know, trying to tell an older nurse or you need to change, that's a little bit hard. Well, you know, I did some research into what they were talking about, and read a lot, and I thought, okay, well, I'll give it a try here and see exactly if this is supposed to be the best way. Let's see what happens. And I found that, yeah, you could deviate from certain things because things basically, they're not written in stone like sedation. Why sedate somebody if you absolutely really don't have to? And so when I came to the ICU, the walking awake ICU, part of it surprised me and some of it didn't. I thought it was a great concept simply because I've seen a lot of patients that have been sedated for, you know, days or a week, become very deconditioned, not only pulmonary wise, but overall physical wise. You know, they muscle strength and deconditioned to their extremities, and they were crazy in the head, if you want to say, because they were delirious. Mm-hmm. And with being off sedation, you actually still can interact with them, other than the fact that they can't talk back, they can write. And I saw they did so much better, so much better.
And in what ways did they do better?
They did better. They came off the ventilator quicker. Emotionally, I think they were better. Physically, they were a lot better because, you know, even setting up on the side of the bed and having them brush their own hair or, you know, performing their own mouth care, even though that, you know, not every patient, in my opinion, needs to be restrained. They were able to wash their face, do their own mouth care, suction their mouth. They had some control over their situation. They weren't helpless, in my opinion. They participated in their care. They were alert. They were oriented. You interacted. They knew the day-to-day happenings. And mentally wise, I think it they did 100% better.
Yeah, that is so interesting. And I love that you mentioned even all those self-cares. And I noticed working with you that you spend a lot of time in your patients' rooms, just that one-on-one bedside. And so what did that do for your personal fulfillment or your connections with patients when they weren't sedated?
Well, looking back over the years, you know, when somebody was sedated on the ventilator and restrained, you know, hopefully the nurses were, you had a nurse that, you know, did the every 2 hour turning mouth care, repositioning type nursing functions. That is a standard practice. But a lot of times you didn't. There was nurses that did not participate fully in patient care and delivering, you know, a full 100% good package to them and giving them what they needed. And what I mean by what they needed is range of motion, positioning properly, releasing restraints and you know, moving their arms and flexion and extension. You know, a lot of that, I don't think sometimes people realize how quickly your muscles can atrophy and lose muscle strength. Even simply head positioning can cause some issues, especially if you have shortening of the muscles in the neck and the tendon. You know, you could have a head jacked to the one side and, you know, you're not able to raise your arms because you've had shortening of the muscles in your shoulders and everything. It makes it hard to even, you know, raise your arm and put a shirt on. And I don't think a lot of nurses are being taught that. It's basically a lot of in and out, do what you need to do and get out of the room. And then you find the nurses that do like to spend a lot of time. I like to spend a lot of time with my patients because I think it's what they deserve and it's what I'm paid for. I want the best outcome for them possible. So that's why, you know, I always felt that, you know, that's why I became a nurse. You know, if it takes going the extra mile to do it, I will do it. And if it means, you know, not getting a lunch because the patient's in need, that's the way it goes.
Well, I hadn't even thought, this is so silly, but, you know, I hear physical therapists talk about helping prevent contractures and things like that, but I just don't see it that often because our patients don't really get them. I mean, they're moving themselves. They don't lose the capacity to put their shirts on or to put their hands over their heads or things like that. And like you said, a lot of them don't have to be restrained So those are just things that I think we're more programmed to have ambulate TID be the standard rather than turn Q2.
Right. And that works very well when somebody is, you know, if the condition allows someone to be up and ambulating, up in the chair, sitting on the side of the bed, you know, obviously supervised, it's so much better to do that than to have somebody in the bed sedated and turning them every 2 hours.
Pressure ulcers in the awake and walking ICU?
No, I didn't. No. That's also a big thing is when someone's able to move and shift their hips or turn over themselves, or you assist them in turning over, but they're awake. If they're awake and they realize, like we normally do when we're asleep in our own beds, when pressure or something stimulates us to turn over, to change our position, when they're awake, they're cognizant of needing to turn over, and they can turn their call light on and say, I want to turn over. And that works so much better in prevention of pressure ulcers, which is, you know, a huge financial burden and a huge life-altering issue with a patient that winds up with a stage 2 or 3 pressure ulcer.
Yeah, such a good point. So I forget that is such a problem in this population, because when you get different treatment, you get different outcomes, even down to pressure ulcers and skin breakdown. And you worked as a night nurse. I mean, that's your groove. And so one of the big focuses on delirium prevention is sleep. And so what benefits did you see to sleep when you were walking people before they went down to bed?
Well, it kind of kept somewhat of a normal circadian rhythm, if that's the word, how you say it. It, you know, they were up through the day, activity, kept awake. Then we come into the evening mode and they do some activity, whether walk up in the chair, get their teeth brushed, mouth cleaned out. And then most of the time they were tired and they just wanted to go to sleep. And hopefully you could keep them up to at least 10 o'clock, which would always work better.
Mm-hmm.
And they would get sometimes, you know, several hours of uninterrupted sleep, which I think plays a huge role in delirium prevention, as well as instituting a sleep hygiene protocol.
So you saw people get real sleep. That's one of the concerns, is that, well, there's a lot of confusion as far as people believe that sedation is sleep. So that's a problem to begin with. And
right.
Then there's a concern, and it's a valid concern, that people will be so uncomfortable that they won't be able to sleep on the ventilator without sedation. So you saw patients sleep and getting real sleep.
Yes, I did. I don't think sleeping on the ventilator with a breathing tube to some people is no different than sleeping with a BiPAP on or a CPAP.
Mm-hmm.
I think they're just as, they can, if they're able to tolerate it psychologically, which most of the time I've seen that happen. They're psychologically, they are able to tolerate it a lot better than sometimes even just being on BiPAP with a face mask on. But they do. They go to sleep, and I've asked them before, you know, do you feel you are rested? And I've had many tell me yes, versus someone being chemically sedated and then you waking them up. I don't recall that anyone's ever said that they felt like they've slept the best they ever had.
No, survivors say that it was very unrestful and not peaceful at all.
Well,
it's scary to think of going days to weeks without any restorative sleep. Anyone would lose their minds.
Yeah.
And so before coming to the Wake and Walking ICU, you probably hadn't really walked people on ventilators. Then here you are as a night shift nurse, walking people on ventilators without physical therapy, because we don't have physical therapy at night. What was that like for you?
It was just, you know, honestly, it was just rearranging your time to incorporate that into your evening plan. I have no problem, and I feel that I've always been very proactive with things that would benefit my patient. And if they're able to get up and you have the capacity or the means to ambulate them, I'm all for it. I was actually quite excited about it. I felt like it was a major turning point in a learning curve for me, that, wow, look what we are doing here. And I've even, you know, told friends that are nurses, back in my home state, we don't sedate. We walk, they're up, and they're totally surprised. I said, we have less incidence of delirium. The patients come off the ventilator sooner. And it's totally, I think, 100% better.
I think people try to imagine their deconditioned patients jumping out of bed. And I think it's hard to imagine never letting people get deconditioned.
Correct.
And how much safer it is, and that they are able to throw their legs over the side of the bed, stand up. Some people walk out of the ICU stronger than they rolled in.
Correct.
And so we think, I mean, there are precautions you have to take. But did you feel unsafe walking patients? Did you feel like they were going to collapse on you? Was anyone army crawling blue on the floor?
No, you know, part of a good nursing assessment is assessing, you know, the capabilities or their ability. Are they ready for this? Can they do this? If I felt that they weren't ready mm-hmm. to do, let's say, a complete walk around the unit, let's move up to sitting on the side of the bed for a minute. Let's stand. Let's walk to the door and let's walk back.
Yep.
And then, you know, it's like deconditioning happens because we allow it to happen.
Ooh.
We allow it to happen in people that come in the into a hospital that is ill, becomes critically ill, and or ill enough that they require assistance with breathing. But physiological wise or body mechanics wise, they're still strong, but we allow that become weak even within a day or two of laying in a bed. And I think nursing in general needs to come up with a new idea on evaluating these people and beginning early ambulation as soon as possible.
Yeah, and it's the multidisciplinary approach. I think sometimes physical therapy isn't even ordered until days after admission because people are newly intubated, they have high ventilator settings, or it's just not on the radar on admission. But you were probably getting people that had just been admitted that afternoon and you're walking them that night, right? They're newly intubated and you're
right.
Yes.
And if they're capable of doing that, you don't tie them to a bed and sedate them to make your night easier. That's not what we're there for.
Wow.
At least that's not what I was there for.
That is powerful. I mean, what a disservice to patients to take away their capacity to walk. They come in with their critical illness, but why does the rest of the body have to decline because they have pancreatitis, sepsis, pneumonia, all these other things that had nothing to do with total body strength? Though it all plays a role, but if we can do our part to combat the effects of those and keep them functional, why wouldn't we do that? Why would we take away their capacity to walk? Paula, that's so powerful. And so you had all these experiences there, and then you went to a different ICU. And so what was that like hitting a whole new culture again?
Well, it was basically like a bounce back, bounce back into an era of, no, we sedate, and when they're on the ventilator, we start sedation. I tried to have the approach, why are we sedating them? Let's see what they do.
Mm-hmm.
Propofol is such a short-acting medication, and if you're using that to sedate somebody, to intubate them, let's let them wake up and see how they're responding to you. And I have had a lot of people, they wake up and they're waking up slowly, and you're talking to them, you're telling them, you know, relax, and just nice breathing, easy, you're doing great. And I've had a lot just wake up and be like, look at you. And I said, okay, you got your breathing tube. And why, honestly, that facilities aren't promoting more slow awakenings like that, just let mm-hmm. them wake up. And if they're tolerating it and everything is good, their physiological numbers are in place, they're not having any problem, why not let them ride like that? You know, why put sedation on someone that doesn't need it?
Our other former colleague, Jim, he had said in a post something like, I'm waking my patients up and the only anxious people are my coworkers that don't get it.
He's exactly right.
Is that what you found, or what? How did the team receive your approach when you were waking up their patients?
Well, I remember one morning I had worked, and or one night, and morning was coming, new shift was coming in, and the patient that I had was ventilated, wide awake, suctioning her mouth, watching the news, had her call light, you know, motioning for me and writing things. And we were communicating, and she, you know, her pressures were good. Her heart rate was great. Her respiratory effort was much easier. I mean, she was, you know, the ventilator was helping her, and she psychologically was, I should say, dancing with the whole thing.
Yeah, and, it was grooving.
Right. And the looks on the oncoming shift's face was, oh my gosh. I was like, pay no attention, walk on, you know, she's fine. Everything's good. It was shocking to them. And I should say, thank goodness, the oncoming nurse that received my patient was very open to leaving her as is.
Good.
And as a matter of fact, I believe it was Jim, his wife.
Oh.
And she was very open to that and a little apprehensive, but I'm glad she took my advice and she did. And I think later on that afternoon, the lady was extubated and was doing fine. So she gets a breathing tube out and she's still, I mean, it's just like you're going to the physician, to a dentist and having a filling. So, you know, we took the breathing tube out and exchanged it for a nasal cannula. Was she confused? No. Was she able to get up in the chair? Yes. And was she anxious? No. And it's those things that I think I don't know if it's generational with nursing or it's just the climate that people work in, that they're taught one after the other, this is how we do it. And they don't think, well, let's try deviating a little bit and let's see what we get. And I know the facility, they still sedate. Nursing is not as interactive with the patients as what, you know, perhaps I would be. Lack of turning, lack of physical mobility. Then, like you said, on the weekends when physical therapy is not there, or, you know, sometimes physical therapy can only be there once a day, PT or OT. So does that mean we neglect our patient as far as, you know, range of motion or setting them on the side of the bed or say, hey, let's get up in the chair for an hour? No, I think that's part of the standard of care that's evolving that nurses need to adapt to, change their attitude towards, and be proactive.
Yeah, a couple episodes ago, we had Chris Perme. She's a physical therapist that teaches ICU rehab, and she kind of has this catchphrase that mobility is everyone's job.
Correct.
And nurses already have so much going on, but other nurses that I've interviewed have said, it's part of my assessment. It's just part of my treatment. It's just part of our flow. They make it kind of this natural process. It doesn't feel like it's a whole new chore. It does require effort to get a patient up, but it's a lot easier if you do it from day one than if you do it 5 days later once they're weak. You really can do it with one other person, sometimes by yourself, when they can actually participate. So you don't take away their capacity to do it. And then the patient themselves can do it for themselves, or they can help you help them. But it's so much of the climate, like you said, of the environment that you work in, the mentality and the culture of where we're raised, where we've worked before, what we've experienced. Did you find people be excited about learning something new or your approach?
Not exactly. I think they took into consideration what was being said, but as far as actually being self-motivated to perform activities, it was easier to keep someone sedated and restrained on a ventilator than it was to make that extra effort. Meaning I shouldn't say it was a babysitting method, but it was a way, if my patient's sedated, ventilated, and restrained, then I'm going to have an easy night.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, what's an easy night? an easy night to me is if I take care of both of my patients and get my charting done without sedating them or restraining them.
And an easy night for you is not necessarily an easy night for the patient. But if we have this misconception about what is going on during that with that patient, they look like they're asleep. So it makes us feel like we've tucked them in, the sheets are nice and tidy, all the lines are in place, and we don't have to mess with them. But is that really comfortable for the patient? Is that a good night for the patient? They're not actually sleeping. They're having terrorist hallucinations, but we don't see that.
No, we don't. And, you know, I think with some of your, one of your other podcasts I've listened to, you know, the lady was talking about, you know, the, you know, thought people were trying to kill them and they were being held against their will. And, you know, your mind's a powerful organ, and you get somebody, you know, you alter their mental thinking with drugs, and we don't understand, or we don't know. And it's what's so good about what you're doing to bring about awareness of in these people that are recovering, what is going on in their head. Mm-hmm. You know, are we psychologically torturing them by trying to physiologically get them better? And I think psychological torturing and physical healing, they don't go together.
Right.
You've got to be willing to take that time. And one thing that I found myself falling into very easily, which surprised me, was performing guided imagery with patients. And, you know, they're scared. They don't know who you are. Should they trust you? You were the nurse that was there last night and, you know, strapped them to the bed. But actually taking the time to mentally relax them and to get them in a zone that they can relax and feel comfortable, I think is just as important. And I could not imagine what someone who is possibly alert enough to hear the going ons and the sounds and the dings and the other patients yelling and staff laughing and that type of thing. What are they thinking
when they don't know where they are, what's going on?
Exactly. Yeah. I had a lady tell me one time, this was many, many years ago, back when we used yellow isolation gowns, that when we went into her room, she thought we were big yellow birds coming into her room. And that's what she told me. I was like, oh my gosh. And
makes sense.
Yeah. And so, you know, what we perceive to be normal is not normal.
Right. And I've heard from nurses around the country that they sedate because it's more comfortable for the patient. It's more humane. It prevents PTSD. They say things like, I'd rather be asleep on the ventilator than awake and experiencing the ICU. And so I think, yes, it's much easier to sedate and it makes for a much easier shift than having to actually talk to patients or move them. Yet I deeply believe that nurses are so good, and a lot of the cultural barriers come from a lack of awareness. They don't understand what it's like down the road to have the PTSD, the cognitive deficits, the weakness. They just don't have the big picture. But as we continue to talk about this and just show that it is possible and completely feasible to mitigate a lot of this harm while patients are on ventilators, those good nurses, which are the majority, if not all, are going to catch on to it and totally change the culture. But I think it starts with awareness first, and then our own convenience seems insignificant compared to the actual success of the patient.
Oh yeah, I agree. I mean, I think there are nurses that are nurses and are caring and will go the extra mile. And I think there's nurses that are mechanical, meaning you do what is on the 8 p.m. checkoff list and you do nothing more.
Mm-hmm.
It's a culture, and it's a culture that needs to be changed. And, you know, to change that culture in a unit that has never done such behavior activities, like, you know, it takes people that are willing to, physicians especially, to allow you to experiment. And what I mean by that is, you're teaching, you're showing them, we're lightening the sedation by this, and You get the patient nice and awake, and, you know, you move forward with activity and mobility, that type of thing, communication, reorientation, and you teach these nurses.
Yeah, it truly is a skill set. I think we just kind of get used to doing these things, but we forget how moving patients is not an innate skill set for ICU nurses, especially when you first come in, right? And you're used to just having patients be immobilized and comatose in bed. It's a whole new skill set to figure out how to move the ET tube around, move the ventilator around, just have the comfort and the instinct to do that. And then it's a new skill set to wake someone out of sedation who's delirious and agitated and have a confidence that you can work them through that, that that sedation will wear off, the delirium will clear, and that they will be calm. It takes a whole nother set of experience, perspective, and patience and skills to do that. And so I think you're right. It takes more than just one nurse and one unit at the bedside. It's going to take some support, people that have done it before or really believe in it and that can stay calm and see through the fog and look at the big picture of the patient's outcomes.
Yeah, you're right. It does. You know, I know in the era or the way things are kind of now with not only with multiple facilities is lack of support staff. And I think that's where places need to go back and really evaluate how important support staff are in assisting the nurse to help the patient accomplish a goal that ultimately will reduce hospital time, delirium, hospital, you know, financially, it's going to reduce the cost of a prolonged hospitalization with multiple complications.
And we're starting to touch on some episodes that are down or that are coming as far as how to change the culture, the financial repercussions of these practices. There are just so many rabbit holes that we're going to dive into as this podcast unfolds, but you are so right about everything. And it for me is exciting to hear about good nurses like you that had so much experience and brought such a wealth of knowledge, but also you were still open to learning and changing. And then you were willing to bring that elsewhere. And so that's exciting to me because I know that our field, whether they're doing it or not, people are going to be willing to do it. I think nurses just need the opportunity to know and the support to do. And then things are going to roll.
I agree. And, you know, a lot of the newer nurses that now are coming directly into the ICU, they're learning habits from the ones that's been there longer, mm-hmm. or perhaps just within even a year. And we need to be very aware of what we're teaching our new people, our new nurses. And we need to teach them how to do certain things. And
the why.
Right. And how to interact with your patient appropriately. How to get them over a hump. And I've told many a patients that were like awake and maybe having some anxiety, if you will follow me and bear with me, I will get you through this. Just listen to what I'm asking you and what I'm telling. Mm-hmm. Okay. I've got a lot of people through that. And that's, you know, that's one thing with like learning to guide someone through a bad situation. And I think a lot of new nurses even don't know how to do that. They don't know how to do it even with patients off the ventilator, like in a death situation. They don't know how to guide a family member, you know, on this journey. And teaching people how to guide people is hard for some, and they don't do it.
Yeah, that would probably be a good podcast episode too, like how to truly connect and walk patients through anxiety, fear, death, all those phases. Oh, Paul, you're giving me so many good ideas. Thank you so much for all your good work and being willing to share all of this with us. I'm excited for everything that's to come in your future and the future of our community. Thank you so much.
You're very welcome. Very welcome.
If you want to join in on the conversation, leave a voicemail at 801-784-0472 or reach out to me on Twitter.